Back again to the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Wednesday, April 24th, 2013, and this is podcast number 306. My name is Ben Stone. A couple quick updates. I'm not going to go into the commercials I've been doing for Porkfest and everything for sake of time. I did want to mention that we have the Bad Quaker Top 50 podcasts put together, with the help of the folks on the forum and with the help of email requests and so forth. And I'll be getting information to you on that in the near future, including a list of what the top 50 podcasts were chosen to be and how to access them and all that kind of information in coming up eventually sometime, probably. I want to thank the donors that have been supporting badquaker.com. You know, a couple weeks ago or whenever it was, we had sort of a session where I came on and did my little, telethon type PBS beg session. And since then, we've just had a real steady, a steady amount of donations that just keep coming in. And I really appreciate that. Probably the average, there have been some that were significant, and I really appreciate that. But the average is around $20 or so, $20, $25, something like that. And I really appreciate that. I want you to understand that that those really mean a lot to me. But even if you can't, if you want to help badquaker.com, but you can't really do that with $20 or whatever, even like $5 or whatever, we really appreciate it. And I'm bringing that up because I haven't really put enough emphasis on the fact that if you go to the forum, to the Bad Quaker forum, and you can find that on the right hand, there's a button in the upper right hand side of badquaker.com, you can make set up a profile on the forum, and we do have a way to join the forum as a paid member, and I think it's something like $3 or $4 a month or something like that, or something like $20 a year, and you get access to the paid area of the forum. So that's just an option, and I'm not really comfortable coming on the podcast begging for money and so forth, but I haven't mentioned that enough, and I haven't made that clear enough that is an option for you. So now right into the real podcast today. Yesterday I had Will Coley on, and I had a real nice talk with he and his wife, and I meant to mention that Will Coley was one of the 2012 Liberty Inspiration Award winners. He was up there with Ron Paul and Stefan Molyneux and some of those other big shots like that. And it's really an honor to know Will and to work with him like this. And I'm really pleased that I'm going to be able to see him at Porkfest. I'm really happy about that. Now, I had a listener question in email, and I'm kind of surprised that two things. I'm surprised that I didn't talk about this, and I'm also surprised that no one else sent me this question, but it's a really, really good question, and I'm going to paraphrase it. I'm not going to read his actual email, but I'm going to paraphrase the question. He basically said, you know, I've talked about the Taliban, and I've talked about the poppy harvest in Afghanistan, and I've talked about how the Taliban in 1 year just eradicated the poppy harvest. I mean, it just went to zero almost. And they just shut down the poppy fields of Afghanistan. And so this listener's question was, how was the Taliban able to successfully eradicate the poppy harvest in Taliban during the 2000 growing season? And he says, you know, surely this is not a model of government success in the war against drugs, or, you know, how did they do this, and what was the effect and so forth? And this is a really good question. And it's the problem is it's not a simple question. You can't just go to the year 2000 and draw a little happy face with eyes and a little smile and say, well, there it is. That's what happened. And that may be why I haven't gone into it in the past, is because it's an extremely complicated question, and you have to look at almost 10 years of history there to really to get a grasp of how the Taliban stopped the poppy harvest in 2000, and what led up to that, and what was the repercussions of that. So, I mean, well, got to do it. So this is what I'm going to talk about today. Now, in laying the groundwork in this, you need to understand that, okay, first off, we're talking about the farmers and tribal leaders in Afghanistan that they're actually, you know, growing the poppies. And you have to understand that in any situation like this, the farmers get a very small cut of the profits, barely enough to live on. And this is kind of the same, sadly to say, this is kind of the same in all farming areas, except the United States, where there's massive government support for the farmers. And if you're the right kind of farmer, a government-selected farmer, you can make a lot of money farming. Not every farmer does that, but the ones that are carefully selected by the government make lots of money farming, or actually a lot of farmers make a lot of government money by not farming. But anyway, not the point in today's podcast. But in more, how do you say it, non-government interfered farming situations, farmers get very little of the cut of the profits of any product, you know, generally speaking. But this is especially true with something that's an illicit product like poppies. Of course, poppies are used in the production of heroin, of opiates. Most of the Afghan poppy harvest goes into the illicit trade, not into the legitimate trade. I think, if I recall, most poppies that are grown for medicinal purposes that are acceptable to the governments of the world, like opiates for medication and so forth. If I recall, Turkey is the largest producer of that type of poppies. But getting back to the point. So the farmers in Afghanistan, the actual guys who are out there planting and harvesting, they make a tiny, tiny cut of the profits. The Afghan government, the Taliban at that time, back in the 1990s and so forth, the Taliban government got a very small cut in the form of taxation. They actually taxed the tribal leaders who controlled the farmers and who controlled the crops. So the Afghan government got a very small cut in the form of taxation. The tribal leaders only took a small, you know, relative here to the overall amount of money that's exchanging hands because of the poppy and harvest and the heroin production. The tribal leaders got a very small cut of the deal. They got a bigger cut than the farmers, and they got a bigger cut than the government, than the Taliban. But proportionately, the tribal leaders still didn't really get that big of a cut of the pie of the, you know, of the whole opium drug trade. So now we also have people who are within the drug trade who are considered mules, the handlers, the mules, the enforcers, the bribes that are given to small government officials in other countries where the drugs are being either passed through or the drugs are being distributed. You got bribes going to government officials there, bribes going to local police in places like that where the drugs are being either transported or distributed. So you have small amounts of the cut going to each of these, the mules, the handlers, the enforcers, the bribes, all that takes a small amount, but of course it adds up. And then, in these situations, the largest cut always goes to the leaders of the distribution network. So if we're talking about, you know, Central America or Mexico and the illicit drug trade that goes on there, of course, by far the largest cut goes to the cartels that control the drug trafficking in and out of Mexico and in and out of Central America, and far less goes to the local distributors. Once they get it into the country of destination, there's a dividing up there as well. But by far, the largest cut always goes to the leaders of the distribution network. Now, in Afghanistan, in the 1990s, I'm sorry, but that was the CIA. That was the CIA and their operatives, the people that were officially in the CIA and the people who worked with the people who were officially in the CIA. And I've talked before about the particular banking company that was based in Pakistan that was part of this and everything else. But anyway, okay, so this is the pattern that we have. The farmers get very little. The Afghan government got very little. The tribal leaders got a little bit more. A little bit went to the mules, the handlers, the enforcers, the distribution, the actual on-the-street sellers, pushers, whatever you want to call them. And a little bit went to bribe the government officials and police and so forth. But the big cut went to the distribution network, the actual leaders of that distribution network, the money people, the in Afghanistan, the CIA and those guys. Okay. Now, if you remove, you have this situation with supply and demand. If you remove a supplier, then the demand will drive the price up and the market creates more incentives either to bring that supplier back into the market or to bring another supplier into the market. So it's kind of like scooping a bucket of water out of the ocean. In a sense, you have removed part of the supply of water, but others fall into line immediately. It's because there's a constant demand there. You know, gravity is equal everywhere, and well, essentially for the pattern that we're discussing here. So if you scoop out a bucket of water out of the ocean, and immediately the water fills back in, and that's the way the market is with pretty much any product. There may be a tiny measurable delay, but eventually somebody's going to put that supply back in. So in 2000, what happened? How did this take place? Well, let's back all the way up to from 1991. When the Soviet Union fled Afghanistan in defeat, from 1991 to 1996, there was no actual government in Afghanistan. There was a lot of local, there was a lot of local rule. There were tribal rulers. There were warlords. There were tribal elders, and there was a lot of violence. And it was a CIA wonderland. They were able to just do pretty much anything they wanted to do. And you know the drug trade increased almost every year. Well, it did every year. It increased, and that was the condition. Now, in 1996, the U.S.-backed Taliban came into power. The Taliban were essentially young men that had been on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Many of them were refugees. Many of them were orphans. They had been raised in the radical schools that the CIA had set up with with Pakistan. So they actually believed all the most radical aspects of Islamic law that the CIA had pushed through, largely through pamphlets, printed in the U.S. and hauled to those schools for the purpose of militarizing people against the Soviet Union. Well, the unintended consequence of the CIA's actions in doing that was to create a whole generation of young men who had lived their whole life as refugees, as orphans, and been raised in these radical schools backed by the CIA. And so by 96, the Taliban was strong enough that they swept in and were able to get control of the government in Kabul and one of the other major cities that I can't remember. It leaves my mind at the moment. Anyway, and that pretty much gave them control of the country, not completely, but pretty much, is at least in an international view of the situation. So the Taliban comes in 96, and initially DC is really happy about this because they totally misunderstood what it was that the CIA had created there, and the CIA misunderstood as well. They had no clue as to what it was, this thing that they had created. They totally misunderstood these unintended consequences. By 1997, in 1997, top members of the Taliban actually came to Washington, D.C. and met with U.S. State Department officials, part of Madeleine Albright's staff at the time. And there's a widely quoted statement here that came out of the State Department spokesman after those meetings with the Taliban. And they expressed a sort of a goal The goal of the State Department in helping the Taliban was to set up a government similar to the Saudi Arabian government that would be friendly to the U.S. and that would work with Western oil companies. And the quote from that press conference where the State Department spokesman actually made a statement, the quote is, "The Taliban will probably develop like the Saudis. There will be an Aramco, A-R-A-M-C-O, that was the Western group of oil companies that originally controlled the Saudi oil. Anyway, so he says there will be that, and there will be pipelines, and there will be an emir, there will be no parliament, and there will be lots of Sharia law. And he said, we can live with that. This was the spokesman. Now, this is a widely quoted thing that was all over at the time, but the State Department spokesman who came out after the meeting, it was so unimportant that the media didn't even bother to record who this spokesman was. I can find this quote all over the internet from different sources, everything from, all over major networks and so forth, but none of them quote who the source was. And the reason why is because it was a very minor thing in its time. It was like, who in America, who knew what the Taliban was? How many people actually knew where Afghanistan was? Who cared who was in charge of Afghanistan? I mean, it was just not something that the news media was really all that interested in, and the American people had very little interest in it as well. So, again, we're talking about 1997, and now, based on this meeting between the Taliban and the U.S. State Department, Unocal, the old Union Oil of California, started putting together a group of oil companies, and they proposed a $4.5 billion oil and gas pipeline that would lead from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan and to Pakistan, eventually reach the Indian Ocean. And this was a very important thing. A lot of effort was put into this. Now, Unocal didn't plan on using its own money for this. You, the taxpayer, were going to end up putting out a lot of this. Unocal just wanted in on the contracts and wanted in on the ability to be a part of getting that oil flow and the cash that flows with it. So now, by early of 1998, and at this time, of course, the Taliban has only been in power for 2 years. By early 1998, human rights groups were starting to scream about the treatment of women under the authority of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime was complaining to the U.S. about the U.S.-backed Afghanistan government and how it was encouraging poppy production. Now, the evidence that the UN used to say that the Afghan government was backing these farmers in growing poppies was the fact that the Afghan government was taxing the poppy production. So in the weird, twisted minds of these people in the UN, taxing something was the same as supporting it. It was really weird. If we use that example and we talk about something in the U.S., like perhaps cigarettes, if taxing cigarettes means supporting cigarettes, then the Afghan government was supporting poppies. But that's the backwards economic thinking that statists have. Like, if you tax it, you're supporting it. If you tax it, you're harming it. If you tax it, everybody's happy. If you tax it, you're improving things. If you tax it, not the topic. So, where were we? In 1998. 1998 was really the first time the American public, even though there was this visit in 1997 of the Taliban to Washington, D.C., like I said, nobody noticed, nobody cared. It was only in 1998 when the American public really heard about the Taliban. And the way the American public heard about the Taliban was by the human rights groups complaining about the way women were being treated in Afghanistan. So for the first time, Americans are like, hey, something's going on over there. Well, this kind of made the Clinton administration look bad because the Clinton administration was all, you know, they're liberals and they're all supposed to be about human rights and all this kind of thing. Back when people still believed that liberals were for human rights, that's how far, you know, how far we've come since then. And in general, 1998 was not a good year for Billy Clinton. You know, Clinton, he's developing a black eye over supporting the Taliban. 98 was the year that the war in Kosovo really broke out. Clinton authorized airstrikes in Kosovo. There was NATO airstrikes. There's a lot of controversy about whether those did more harm than good. This is the area time frame when there were complaints that under Bill Clinton's watch, American soldiers were having to wear NATO uniforms and UN uniform, UN insignia. And so there was a lot of scandal about that. Right in the middle of all that, the Monica Lewinsky scandal breaks out. Like, you know, like that. Well, and you can say, well, that was an intentional distraction. Or you can say that the other things that Clinton did was a distraction from the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It's all according to how you look at it. But right in that same time frame, Clinton faced impeachment. By August 7th of 1998, all these things had happened. You know, the Clinton administration was already starting to look bad over a number of things, including the human rights violations by the Taliban. You have the war in Kosovo going on, you have the Lewinsky thing going on, you have Clinton facing impeachment, and then August 7th, there are explosions in two U.S. embassies, one in Kenya and one in Tanzania. Hundreds of people were killed. And of course, the American people hear about this, and it's all over the news, and you see the pictures and the tragedy and the and all the horrible things that happen with an attack like this. And of course, you know, guided by the media, the American public just looks at it and they think, well, two wild, crazy terrorist explosions with absolutely no motive. They're just random, simple acts of terror. It's sort of that Forrest Gump view of history, like, I don't know, we were just walking along and all of a sudden Forrest jumped up and bit me. That kind of mentality, like there's no connection of one event with any other event. We're just walking through life and all of a sudden things happen and we don't stop and analyze why they happened or anything like that. We just keep walking along. Well, when that happened, when the two embassies were bombed, Osama bin Laden released a statement that the bombings happened directly because the U.S. invasion of Somalia and the American plan to partition Sudan. And he also claimed sort of like a press release, he claimed that the genocide that had been going on in Rwanda was a plot that it was a U.S. government-backed plot, and that it had been planned in those two embassies, the same two embassies that got bombed. And that was Osama bin Laden's explanation as to why these two bombs took place, because of the U.S. invasion of Somalia, because of the American plan to partition Sudan, and because his allegation that the U.S. was involved in the planning of the genocide in Rwanda. Now, also as an added bonus to that, the bombings took place on the anniversary of the U.S. moving troops into Saudi Arabia that the U.S. never moved back out, and that was widely believed as a religious insult to Osama bin Laden. So now we're in August of 1998, and this is the first time the American public ever heard of Osama bin Laden. Prior to that, the name was just not in the press. It was not something that Americans knew anything about. This guy just appeared out of nowhere with this statement saying this is why the two embassies were bombed. Well, of course, Americans couldn't accept that because they have this Forrest Gump version of history in their mind. There couldn't be a reason behind it. It's just madness. It can't be, you know, people don't just go and get blown up like that because of a reason. These things are just random and they're just, you know, angry Islamic madmen, and that's what causes this. That's the American public way of thinking. So when Osama bin Laden comes out and, you know, presents reasons for this, specifically reasons that the U.S. government was involved in horrible things, well, we can't have that. So Bill Clinton almost immediately came on primetime TV in America and proclaimed Osama bin Laden as the bad guy. He was the guy behind all this, and announced that the U.S. would strike back. And it did on August 20th of 1998, same month, just a few days later, Operation Infinite Reach unleashed a series of U.S. cruise missile strikes in Sudan and Afghanistan. Now, it's really interesting, in Sudan, the cruise missile strikes in Sudan hit the country's primary pharmaceutical factory. 50% of Sudan's medicine that went both for humans and for animals were manufactured in that factory. And the Clinton administration claimed that this factory produced chemical weapons. Of course, thorough investigation afterwards showed that was a lie. That it just simply made it was just a medicine factory. That's all they did. They just made medicine, and you cut off half the supply of medicine to Sudan's population with that cruise missile attack. Now, in Afghanistan, the U.S. sent 75 U.S. Tomahawk cruise missiles to strike four targets. They produced a confirmed killing of one person, a Canadian. Now, let's just think about that for a minute. The U.S. sent 75 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Afghanistan to hit four targets. Of those four targets, there is one confirmed kill. Now, there's some reports that there's maybe 20, but as far as confirmed kills, we know of one person who was killed from those 75 Tomahawk missiles, and he was a Canadian. Osama bin Laden later admitted that they did lose several camels and some chickens were lost in the attack. Now, let's just back up for a minute and think about the Tomahawk cruise missile. These things ran about $1.4 million, million each back in the day. So 75 of them would have cost about $105 million. Now, that's just for the missiles. That's not what it costs to get them there, the cost of moving an aircraft carrier within striking distance, moving, whatever type of platform that they were fired from. That doesn't include all of the technicalities of getting the missiles where they can be within striking range. That's just the cost of the missiles alone. And I remember back when this happened, I had worked for a company that developed the guidance system for the Tomahawk cruise missile. I worked for them in the early 90s on the Tomahawk project, and I remember thinking then, I was off the project, had been for years by that time, but I remember thinking then, all that work to develop these things, to send them across the desert to hit empty targets that are basically, they were unmanned locations. Now, it is true that one of the strikes came really close to hitting, well, Osama bin Laden was planning on being at one of those locations, and at the last minute, due to some circumstances, he changed his mind and wasn't there. So the U.S. has actually, the government has actually said that no, in fact, it was, a near miss, if you can even say that there's such a thing as a near miss. But, according to official statements, the government says, well, we almost got him. But the problem is, the particular location where Osama bin Laden would have been had he not changed his mind is a very large place. And where the missiles hit, they didn't completely destroy the entire facility. They just hit some spots. So there's actually no guarantee, even if Osama bin Laden had been there, there's no guarantee that he would have been actually in the right spot to get hit. Keep in mind, the Tomahawk was a good missile in its day, but it was not like, the drone strikes that we have nowadays. They can sit there with their cameras and they can look and they can, you know, look right at individual people, and they can bring the drone to a point where they fire their Hellfire missile, and they guide it right down and hit the particular pickup truck that the guy is sitting in, or hit the tent that he just walked into, or hit the mud hut that he's, you know, that they can see with their thermal vision that he's actually sitting in a chair in there, and they can hit right where that chair is. They couldn't do that with Tomahawk cruise missiles. You could hit a particular building if you knew enough information about it, but mostly they weren't that. They were good for their day. I don't want to put them down. The Tomahawk was a good missile, but it was not comparable to what we have now. So the odds of them being able to actually kill Osama bin Laden with these 75 cruise missiles is pretty thin, even at the best circumstances. And, you know, like I said, they actually did confirm, we have one confirmed kill and several camels and chickens. So I'm sure that really taught them a lesson. And that certainly makes up for those hundreds of people that were killed at the embassy bombings. And I'm being a smart aleck intentionally there. Okay, now I need to break here, and let's get the commercial out of the way. And then when I come back, I'll pick this back up, and we'll talk about 1998, maybe Clinton's worst year ever. Okay, I'll be right back. Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy, and Amazon has great prices, and in most cases you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of, plus it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give Bad Quaker a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be supporting this podcast. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So, after the cruise missile strikes, again, we're in 1998. After the cruise missile strikes, the FBI put Osama bin Laden on the 10 most wanted list for those two embassy bombings. Now, this is really a side note, and I'm not trying to make too much of a statement out of this, but keep in mind that from that time in 1998... until his death in 2011, or at least his reported death, if we believe the story, Osama bin Laden stayed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list during that whole time. A good portion of that time, he was the top name on the 10 most wanted list. But also keep in mind that the FBI never formally accused Osama bin Laden of 9/11. He was on that list because of those two embassy bombings, and then later for his involvement in the bombing of the USS Cole, the ship, the Navy ship that they rammed a speedboat packed with bombs. They rammed it into the side of the USS Cole. And Osama bin Laden, according to the FBI, is directly tied to that attack and to the two embassy bombings. But the FBI never officially accused Osama bin Laden of the 9/11 attacks in 2001. So make of that whatever you wish. So the Clinton administration demanded that the Taliban extradite bin Laden, and the Taliban refused. Now, by this time, the Taliban was thinking pretty much of themselves. They had, you know, they were young. They seemed like their prospects of power were seemingly almost unlimited. They were gaining more and more support of the locals as they resisted things like the evil Americans and so forth. So they pushed back, and the Taliban refused to extradite bin Laden. Now, this situation is often quoted as happening after 9/11 2001, where the Taliban refused extradition. But this is, I don't know if it's an intentional twisting of history by people who say it, or if it's just a confusion of time frames, you know, I'm not sure. Probably some of both, according to who the teller is. But like I said, it's often quoted that the Taliban refused to extradite bin Laden after 2011. I'm sorry, after 9/11 2001. But this actually happened in 1998 when the Clinton administration tried to get the Taliban to extradite bin Laden. And this was actually thrown in the Clinton administration's face as how weak they were, you know, Republicans and war hawks and so forth, threw this in the Clintons' face as to how weak they were in foreign policy. Why can't you even get this guy extradited? Why haven't we done something about this? So again, 1998 was a really bad year for Clinton. He just faced constant harassment and opposition, and he just seems like he couldn't do anything right that year. So finally, 1998 was over, and you can probably imagine Clinton sitting there on December 31st with a little glass of champagne going, finally, we made it through this thing. So in 1999, the Clinton administration cut off almost all aid to Afghanistan, and through U.S. pressure, the U.N. followed. Now this, and I should say also, the Afghanistan was getting a lot of aid from Pakistan and from Saudi Arabia, and through the U.S. pressure, both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan cut off almost all their aid to the Taliban. Now, at the same time, 1999, the Afghan poppy crop hit record production. It had never been higher than what it was. It was, you know, it was through the roof. The poppy tax, though, didn't make up for the loss. You know, the poppy tax that the Taliban collected from the tribal leaders and so forth didn't make up for the loss of the foreign aid that had been really propping up the Taliban. They were not there. There wasn't a tax base big enough in Afghanistan to supply the Taliban with the money it needed to build up the kind of military that it needed to try to get control and keep control of this sprawling country with all these separate little warlords all over it. And so when the U.S. aid was cut off, and when Saudi aid was cut off, and U.N. aid was cut off, and the Pakistani aid was cut off, the Taliban was bleeding money pretty fast to try to hold their coalition together. And some of the tribes in Afghanistan at the time saw this as weakness on the part of the Taliban, and so their whole coalition started to fall apart. And so they were desperate. You know, they needed to do something quickly, otherwise they were going to be back out of power again. So you know, they were forced to try to negotiate with the different tribal leaders. And eventually they struck a deal with several of the big tribal leaders. And these pro-Taliban leaders, there was kind of a plan that they came up with. They stashed a very large portion of the 1999 of this record crop. The tribal leaders stashed a good portion of it and refused to sell it to the CIA. Now, this really upset the CIA, of course. But, I mean, what can they do about it? They couldn't really, because this all happened internally within these tribal leaders and the farmers and so forth, the CIA didn't even know where the stuff was being hid or how much there was. It was quite upsetting for these CIA drug lords. And oddly enough, right in the mix of all this, in late 1999, the Taliban leaders discovered that growing poppies was forbidden by Islamic law. Now, these were people who had studied Islamic law their whole lives, basically, and were fanatical about Islamic law. And yet, when it becomes a politically important thing to do, then they discovered that growing poppies was forbidden by Islamic law. Now, I don't think, as far as I know, they never stated that selling poppies was against Islamic law. As far as I know, they only proclaimed that growing them was against Islamic law. But either way, in July of 2000, the Taliban officials officially declared that growing poppies was un-Islamic. And they went on this campaign, fields were burned, and opposition tribal leaders were arrested. The CIA operatives and their secondary level CIA helpers were ejected from the country. A lot of them fled into Pakistan. The pro-Taliban tribal leaders ended up grabbing a lot of territory and a lot of the possessions of their competitor tribal leaders. And so it was a big, even though at the same time they were burning Poppy Fields, if you were the right tribal leader, then your fields weren't burned, and everything that you did grow was stashed, and everything was pulled off the market, and basically the whole market in poppies ceased in 2000. Whether it was by hiding it in caves or burning the fields or just refusing to sell it to the CIA or whatever, in 2000 there was no, officially according to the CIA, there was no harvest. It was very, very tiny, the amount that actually got out of Afghanistan, but essentially there was no harvest in 2000. Now, this, of course, caused the price of heroin, but all the way through the whole gamut, from poppies all the way to heroin, the price skyrocketed during the 2000 season. And Fields, by the end of 2000, of course, Fields were bare, empty, and that took us into 2001, looking like there was not going to be, you know, enough poppies to supply the heroin market for 2001. This is a pretty scary situation, especially if your livelihood depends on it. So by 2001, the poppy fields were bare. A good portion of the farmers were driven off their lands. The CIA was out of Afghanistan almost entirely for the first time since the 1950s. And the Taliban had the blessings of some of the most powerful tribal leaders who were now in possession of poppies that were worth a whole lot more than they had been just previously. So the Taliban was basically drunk with power by 2001. And a good portion of the 1999 and 2000 harvest were still stashed away in caves, especially up in the northern regions of Afghanistan. So the tribal leaders were sitting fine. And again, let me repeat that formula for you. The farmers, in a normal situation, the farmers get a very small cut of the profits, just barely enough to live on. The Afghan government, the Taliban, was getting a very small cut. The tribal leaders got a slightly larger cut under normal circumstances, but they still got a relatively small cut. And then the handlers and the mules and the enforcement branches and bribing government officials and so forth, all that took a little cut of the profits. But in a normal market situation, the leaders of the distribution networks were the ones who were making the big dollars. Except in this situation, those guys were cut out altogether, and the tribal leaders held on to the harvest from 99 and 2000 largely. And so now, when the time came that it was more profitable for them to begin selling again, they're sitting on a very large, valuable product, and they can set their own prices. So it put them in a lot better situation. Here's another thing to think about too. There was a strange arrangement between the tribal leaders and the CIA, and the tribal leaders would actually get paid. Let's put it this way: if you grow under normal circumstances, you grow, let's say, a field of corn, and you take the risk. You might take out a loan if this is how you run your farm. You might take out a loan for the seeds in the beginning of the season. Or you might not. You might have saved your seeds or whatever. But either way, you invest when you plant the seeds, and then you invest all year long as you put any maintenance that's required to keep the field going. And then at the end of the year, you harvest, and you've now invested in that harvest. And then you don't see the profits of that year as a farmer. You don't see the profits of that year until after you've harvested, and then you take it to the market. And that's when you see your profits. But the arrangement that the CIA had with the tribal leaders was the CIA would pay them in advance for the year's harvest. So in 99, and when there actually was a harvest, and the CIA had already paid in advance for those, and so when the harvest came in bigger than had been planned, the tribal leaders actually looked at that as like, well, we got paid for what we were expected to grow from last year, not the bumper crop that we grew this year. So they kind of felt like they'd been ripped off in the deal by getting paid ahead of time and then producing more than they expected to produce. So there was this overabundance that they didn't want to give up to the CIA. Now they're sitting on it. Now they can name their own price for it in 2001. In late 2000 and 2001, they can name their own price. So this takes us into 2001 with bare fields, and there's not the next planting season is not going to be until 2002. So we've got a whole year with absolutely no crops in the ground. Now, here's a thought for you, I think this to be true, but I can't prove it. And I've read other people who have said that they believe it, but I'm not sure that they put all that good of an argument into it either. So I'm not sure I can prove what I'm about to say. But had everything gone, I don't know how you say anything is normal, but if everything had gone normal in 2001, the Taliban was beginning to really lose support fast among the tribal leaders in 2001. And so I think by the planting season of 2002, the Taliban probably would have completely fallen from power, and the tribal leaders would have just said, well, I don't care what you said about the ban on poppy planting, we're doing it anyway. And the Taliban either would have collapsed as a government, or they would have pulled back, because there's no possible way they would have had the power to stand up to the tribal leaders in for the planting season of 2002. But then September 11th, 2001 came along, and for no particular reason whatsoever, some fellas flew airplanes into buildings, and America's Forrest Gump history repeated itself yet again. This interrupted so many things in the world. When September 11th, 2001 happened, and the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, when this happened, it disrupted so many things around the world and so many different groups in their plans and in their schemes. And that includes the Taliban, and that includes the tribal leaders, and that includes everybody involved. It threw a monkey wrench into everything. So Baby Bush, of course, immediately proclaimed that Osama bin Laden was the villain of 9/11. And he immediately announced the invasion of Afghanistan. This is Baby Bush, of course, George W. Bush, not to be confused with Papa Doc Bush that I could talk about, who was George Herbert Walker Bush, CIA man throughout his career. George Herbert Walker Bush, who provided the platform and the island to stage the Bay of Pigs attacks from. George Herbert Walker Bush, who happened to be in Dallas at exactly the time when John F. Kennedy was shot, and then somehow got his memory fuzzed and couldn't remember exactly where he was when Kennedy was shot. That family, that CIA connections, their little boy, Baby Bush proclaims Osama bin Laden as the villain of 9/11 and announced the invasion of Afghanistan. Now, in the following months, the Taliban offered to extradite bin Laden at least three times, and the U.S. ignored each of those offers. And each offer was a little bit different, and each offer was a little bit more U.S. friendly. And the U.S. acted like no offer had ever been made. And the Taliban even complained to the U.N., like, what is with these people? We're offering to get to give this guy up, and they still insist upon invading us. You know, what are we doing? From the Taliban's point of view, I mean, you think about it. The U.S. propped them up, put them in power, then seemingly in their minds, for no good reason whatsoever, the U.S. yanks all their support away and starts giving them a hard time. And then they're like, well, maybe it's over the drugs. So they try to stop the drug flow. And the U.S., still, that can't satisfy these crazy politicians in the U.S. And part of the confusion, and I think this is the case with a lot of people in authority and governments around the world, part of the confusion with dealing with the U.S. is that the U.S. wants different things. The U.S. government, I'm talking about, not the American people. But the U.S. government wants opposite things from countries at the same time. It's like, you know, what do we want? What does the U.S. want from, well, in this case, what does the U.S. want from the Taliban? Well, the U.S. wanted the Taliban to have absolute control in the country and put in hard Islamic law and put in a harsh government like the Saudi Arabia government and get absolute, a military dictatorship essentially in the country, have absolute control in the country, and at the same time, the U.S. government wants the Taliban to be nice to women, to give people, you know, proper human rights, and to not crack down on the population, and to stop the drug flow. And at the same time, the U.S. government wants the drug flow. And so, you know, the Taliban, like any other government that's trying to deal with the U.S. has such opposite demands from, from one set of congressmen are very upset about one particular thing, like the drug war or whatever. That's their thing. That's what they push on. Another set of congressmen, the oil flow is the only thing they care about, and they push and push and push in that direction. Another group is human rights, and they're pushing in that direction. And there's no one central voice coming out of the U.S. government. It always seems to be, no matter what a foreign country does, if they get on the wrong list, then anything they do is going to be wrong. It's like, Saddam Hussein faced this problem. It's like, there was a situation where one of Saddam Hussein's military pilots accidentally fired at a U.S. Ship. It was a mistake. It was a horrible, horrible mistake, and he fires on a U.S. ship. In an attempt to appease the U.S. government, Saddam Hussein actually ordered that the minute that the pilot landed, that they drag him out of the cockpit and kill him on the spot. So they did that. And it's like, see, America, I'm your friend. I do what you say. Almost right after that, not long after that, Papa Bush, of course, practically authorized Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait. And Saddam Hussein waited until he got all the messages correct, and he's like, yeah, the U.S. is going to be fine with me invading Kuwait. And then Iraq invades Kuwait, and immediately Bush starts rattling his saber. And Saddam Hussein's like, wait a minute, what do you want from me? This is opposite messages coming. And he never quite understood. Saddam Hussein, you could see that as time went on, he could less and less understand exactly what it was that the U.S. government wanted from him. Well, that's the same thing the Taliban was going through. They, you know, every time the signals are mixed, we're going to invade you because you have Osama bin Laden. Okay, we'll give up Osama bin Laden. Since you won't give up Osama bin Laden, we're going to invade you. No, wait, we're willing to give him up. Is that what you want? We'll give him up. You want us to stop the poppy harvest? We'll stop the poppy harvest. We'll do it. But yet, it never satisfies the U.S. government, because the U.S. government is not, it's so disjointed, and its foreign policy is so opposite of itself. It crisscrosses over top of itself. So it provides a mixed message. And you also have this other thing where every few years, the U.S. government changes hands to new gatekeepers, and those guys have totally different views and totally different ways of handling things. So, you know, here's a good example. Would Clinton have responded to 9/11 the way Bush did? Who knows? I mean, seriously, who knows? Would he? I don't know. I don't have any way of knowing that. I could probably bet that Clinton would not have used 9/11 as an excuse to invade Iraq. I'd probably be safe in a bet on that. But who knows how Clinton would have handled 9/11 with Afghanistan? Would he have just accepted the extradition? I don't know. Who knows? And the Taliban couldn't guess. They couldn't know either. So 27 days after 9/11 happened, the U.S. invades Afghanistan. By the following spring, the poppy fields in Afghanistan were sprouting. The CIA was back, and they were back with a vengeance. And it's widely believed by analysts that that there were no Taliban at all left in Afghanistan by the spring of 2002. Just within a few months, of the invasion, of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, a lot of the analysts believe that there were no Taliban at all left in Afghanistan, and there certainly were none left in the major cities in any kind of power positions. So this takes us back to the listener's question. How was the Taliban able to successfully eradicate the poppy harvest in Afghanistan during the 2000 growing season? Was it, you know, was it some kind of model for governments in their war against drugs, or was it, well, again, you have to realize that farmers get the very, very small cut of the profits. The Afghan, in that case, the Afghan government, the Taliban, was getting a small tax. The tribal leaders were getting just a small, slightly larger, but small, relatively small cut of the harvest. And of course, we have the mules that are that carry the drugs across borders and so forth. The handlers, the enforcers, bribes to government officials, bribes to local police. All that took a small cut. But in a normal in the normal way that the drug trade works, by far the largest cut always goes to the leaders of the distribution networks. In the case of Afghanistan, that being the CIA operatives. So by the Taliban working with tribal leaders to stop the production for one entire year, which unless I'm confused, if I recall correctly, most of Afghanistan produces a spring and a fall harvest on the poppies. And I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that I recall that being the case, that they produce a spring and a fall crop. But either way, by cutting off the entire supply for a full year while still having reserves to sell, the tribal leaders were able to drive the market up, drive a better price, and negotiate better deals when the CIA was then allowed to come back into their country. And I said that the way I meant to say it. When the CIA was allowed to come back into the tribal leaders' country. Because really, that's what it is. If the tribal leaders in Afghanistan wanted the CIA out today, the CIA would be out today. The tribal leaders in Afghanistan, we can bring in airstrikes, we can bring large quantities of military into Afghanistan, but time has proven the fact that a large, centrally organized military cannot go into Afghanistan and maintain control. There is one way. There's one way you can do it. There's only one way that you can actually get control, that you can take any large, powerful military and get control of Afghanistan. And that is if you go through and you kill everybody who's currently in Afghanistan. If you go through and do that, if you kill everybody in Afghanistan, then the large military can control Afghanistan. But anything less than that, I've said this before, if there's one small little boy standing up on the roof of a mud hut, shaking his fist at the sky, and any invading force decides that they're done with Afghanistan, if you leave one little boy standing on the roof of a mud hut, shaking his fist in the air, he will proclaim victory. He will be convinced in his mind that he has defeated the evil, the evil Americans or whoever that's coming in to invade his country, because that's the way those hill people are. They will not give up as long as they have breath, and to the last one, they will fight until they die. They have done this throughout the ages. They have repelled the Persians. They have repelled Alexander the Great. They have repelled the Mongols. They have repelled India. They have repelled Britain. They have repelled I can't remember the names of the groups, the Islamic invaders that came in the Middle Ages. They have repelled the British, they have repelled the Soviet Union, and now they are in the process of repelling the United States Army, the United States military, I should say. And they'll win. In the long run, the U.S. will have to leave there because the U.S. government will simply not be able to constantly send money and lives into there to be destroyed. At some point in time, the U.S. will have to back out of it. And when they do, whoever's left in Afghanistan will raise their fist into the sky and proclaim victory. So back to the economic position on this. So why would the Afghan warlords and the tribal leaders agree to a suspension of the product for a year? Well, they had two bumper crop years in a row of reserves that they held on to, that they were able to sit on those in reserve and get them through a dry year and come out the other side. And the reason why, of course, is to push the product price up and to negotiate a better deal with the distribution network. And you can kind of compare this to something that Harley Davidson did with motorcycles for many years. For a lot of years there, when the Harley Davidson craze was really going on, the executives at Harley Davidson limited production of all the main Harley motorcycles, and by doing so, they drove the price up. And they had waiting lists of like a year long to buy a brand new Harley. You'd have to go down and sign up on a list a year or a year and a half ahead of time and order it ahead of time. And there was at times there was almost like lotteries of who would be chosen to be able to purchase a new Harley. And while that was all going on, Harley was making big money on things like hats and wallets and sunglasses and boots and T-shirts and T-shirts and T-shirts and T-shirts. Harley Davidson was making money hand over fist selling their logo, and at the same time driving the price of their motorcycles to ridiculous prices, and people were paying it because they were supplying slightly less than the demand. American automakers could maybe learn a trick or two from Harley. But the problem with that is you can't do it forever. Just like with the Taliban, you can't do that forever. At some point, you have to take the plug out and let the product flow. And then when you do, then you can make up with your losses on let everything balance out with one to the other. But and that's kind of what Harley has done as the fad has faded somewhat in recent years. But on the other hand, you know, they're still selling a lot of T-shirts, and the warlords in Afghanistan and the tribal leaders still selling a lot of poppies, and they're making good money at it. Not as good a money as the CIA operatives are making, but they're making good money. Folks, thanks for listening to me today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission, and be sure and click that button over on the right-hand side and go over and take a look at our forum. Thanks a lot, folks.